Welcome back in, everyone, to a fantastic new Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We have a very, very exciting, fresh new show to be sharing with you today, and we are so excited about the guests joining us to talk about it. On our show today, we have Paul Zimmet, who's the co-writer and director of the show, and Ellen Maddow, the co-writer, composer, and a performer in the show. They're here to talk to us about Talking Band's presentation of Shimmer and Herringbone, playing May 1st through the 19th at Mabu Minds at 122 CC. Tickets and more information are available at talkingband.org. This show, just based on the little bit of synopsis we received, sounds fantastic. This is definitely a show for any lover of indie theater, or any lover truly of great costuming as well. So with that, let's go ahead and welcome on our guests, Paul, Ellen. Welcome to Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So happy that you're here, and I can't wait to learn more about this show and be sharing it with our listeners. So let's dive right in right away. Let me start with you, Paul. Can you tell us a little bit about what Shimmer and Herringbone is about?
Yeah, so Shimmer and Herringbone is the name of a clothing store, which is one of most of the show takes place either in the clothing store, in the dressing rooms of the clothing store, or in the plaza outside of a clothing store. And it's a place where the characters come after what is a long winter. It's not kind of specified, but it's a kind of, they've been in hibernation. And actually there's a prologue where you see them on video in their individual apartments, trying on clothes. And the reason they're trying on clothes is because during this long isolation that they've been in, they've been doing a lot of questioning, of reflecting about who they are, and not particularly happy with where their lives are at the present moment. So they have this feeling, well, maybe we can find the clothes that will help define us a little bit better. And they all separately, there's some, actually one is a mother and daughter, come together to this clothing store to not only find clothes, but kind of help them shape an identity that seems more comfortable, more lively, more optimistic for them. And in this clothing store, there's this attendant in the dressing room that Ellen plays, the character named Rhonda, she's kind of a little bit of a busybody, but also very interested in people and interested in what they do. And so she's kind of a major kind of facilitator of their changes and what they're thinking about. And in this central place of this Shimmer and Herringbone, there's all these chance encounters where people who meet up with sometimes strangers. In one case, one of the characters is somebody who's a soap opera, well, like actually a hospital drama, a star for 10 years who people recognize, but other people, some of them knew each other from the past and suddenly just stumble into each other in this dressing room. Some of them have been avoiding each other and happen to meet in the dressing room. So there's all these kind of crisscrossing of these lives that happen in this Shimmer and Herringbone store. Maybe Ellen, I just want to continue maybe a little bit.
No, I think that's kind of it. It's really basically a farce. So there's all these, you know, people running into each other that knew each other a long time ago, that, like Paul said, haven't seen anybody for a while. And then there's all these, what happens is that they find each other. So there's sort of these new alliances or people who, you know, get to be friends for the first time. And you know, really where they find themselves is not only in the clothes, but in the new relationships that they're finding.
And some of those relationships happen to be new loves or new friendships or sometimes reignited loves. And in the case of Rhonda, one of the characters, Gus, they both have this intense interest in books, in novels. And there's this mysterious club that's happening in the basement of the clothing store, which is this bookless club, which they discover, where people come to discuss books without the books, on the premise that they're afraid that the books are disappearing or censored or just not going to be present. So they're sharing what they remember of the books with each other. And it's hard to tell whether this is actually a real club or this is something that they're imagining that's going on in the basement. It's kind of in this mysterious space that's happening in the basement. There's also a live string trio, which is playing on the plaza. So the show is pretty much through composed. Ellen wrote the music, and this string trio is playing music whenever they're outdoors. The music when they're indoors is also composed by Ellen, but that's recorded music as you would have in a clothing store
to get you to shop.
You know,
that kind of thing. But yeah, but the string trio is two violins and a cello. And one of the string players is somebody we've worked with many times in a lot of our productions because we usually have a big musical component in our shows. They're really part of the storytelling. You know, we don't hide the musicians. They're part of the visuals, part of the action. So in this case, like we've done a show before with five horns in it, you know, with horn players, a variety of horn players, and they had to learn a lot of choreography, that kind of thing. So this one, they're part of the action. They're in this urban plaza performing, and yeah, they pretty much play through the piece.
And there's also the set design is very important. We are working with our longtime collaborator, Anna Karai, who is a wonderful designer, and she's also designing the video projections for this show. And as in any farce, there are many doors. And in this case, there are these four panels, large panels, 8x4 panels, which when one side of them is the street and the storefront of Shimmer and Herringbone, and also a projection surface. And when they swing around, they become the doors to the dressing room. So there's a lot of going.
Door choreography.
The scenes move very quickly and fluidly between the outside and the inside, between people coming in through various ways, people just missing each other because one's going out while another's coming in. Kind of classic farce choreography. These panels also are illuminated from the inside. So there's lights inside them. So sometimes they look like a storefront and you can see the objects in the store window from the inside. Or when those lights are not on, they become this projection surface. So for example, I said there's a prologue at the beginning where you see everybody in their own apartments, and that's all on video. At the end, you see these two characters have gone on a road trip as Instagram influencers, and that's also on projections while other live stuff is happening out in front. There's also a lot of pigeons in the piece.
There's a lot about pigeons.
Because one of the characters is an ornithologist. And
we did a lot of research on pigeons. It's very interesting, the history of pigeons.
And pigeons, of course, are gorgeous dressers, so they're not recognized so much sometimes in urban environments, but they have their own beauty. So
they've been bred, you know, they were bred at a certain point to have those different kinds of colors that you see when you know how they all are different, and some of them are different colors and different combinations. I think they were originally for a while bred for those kinds of things, and then they became wild again, but then they kept all those variations. They've kept them as they went back to being wild, so that accounts for some of their costume in real life. I think we should also talk about the beginning of the piece, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We think you would be interested to know how this piece got started.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to also kind of loop in that with what's the inspiration with all of it? Yeah.
Right. So that's we've been doing a series of commissions for our company. This is our 50th season, so we've been working as the Talking Band for 50 years now. And we're doing three productions in this season. Should we talk about those other two now? I mean, we've done two of them already. One was a collaboration with a company called 600 Highwaymen, which is Abigail Browdy and Michael Silverstone. They do a lot of really wonderful work And they're also a husband and wife team, like you guys and like us. And so we started this collaboration with them. It was right before the pandemic, so about 5 years ago, and we've been working on a piece. We worked on a piece with them for a very long time, and we just performed it at the Perlman Art Center, which is that new big marble cube theater that's down in the World Trade Center. So we
were actually the first company in the particular theater there,
right?
In their inaugural season.
And then after that, right after that, we had commissioned Anne Bogart, who's a wonderful director, who we had worked with in the 80s. We commissioned her to direct production, which we did at La Mama that just closed a couple of weeks ago, which is called Existentialism. So we've done those two, and then we have this third one. So for us, it's a really big season. And all these things got started, you know, in the past, but... So then Shimmer and Herringbone, that is all to add up to, Shimmer and Herringbone got started during the pandemic, where we decided to have as our lead artist a costume designer. So we started from the costumes first. And that's Olivera Gajic. And she sent these boxes of pieces of costume, masks, and accessories to six different actors, and people were mostly in different cities. Remember, during the lockdown, people had gone, you know, back home or to somewhere else. So we were all kind of spread out all over, and everybody was, you know, looking for something to do. And so she sent these like surprise packages in the mail to different people. And then they put the things on, and we did these Zoom workshops where we sort of developed characters based on the clothes that she had sent them. And then she sent them more. I think we had a couple of those workshops. And then, you know, when things opened up a little bit more, we started meeting in person. And then Paul and I wrote a play kind of based on the characters that people had come up with during the initial workshops. So it's a big collaborative effort. And then Olivera developed more costumes for these characters. So it was, you know, kind of a circular thing. So that's kind of the basis of it. And, you know, we talked a lot about clothes and how you can present who you think you are by what you wear, or how you show what you don't want to show sometimes by what you wear, or how other people see you by what you wear, and the power of clothing in our lives. So yeah.
And just to say a little bit more about the commissions and like this process with Olivera, the reason we do these commissions is that, you know, as Ellen said, this is our 50th anniversary. So we've been around for a long time. And we have a core bunch of people that we're working with, many of whom are in Shimmer and Herringbone, or we've collaborated with before. But we're always looking for ways to sort of challenge ourselves and throw ourselves off balance a little bit, and, you know, to be working in different ways and new ways. So this idea of starting with the costumes rather than with the set, that the costumes, the inspiration for the play, is something we had tried in different forms before, where Anna Karai, who's the set designer, years ago, we had done a piece called Flipside, where she designed a set first, and then Ellen wrote a play based on the set. So it was sort of flipping the usual order of things. And then, you know, seeking out artists whose work we really admire, like the 600 Highwaymen and Anne Bogart, but who work very differently from us. So it really pushes us in a way to work in ways that we haven't worked before. For example, Michael and Abby in 600 Highwaymen, they work very choreographically, that Abby is also a choreographer. So there's a lot of movement that's connected with the text throughout. And their style is just very different from ours. So it's very interesting to work with them. And then Anne, also being a very, you know, experienced director, has her own way of approaching things. She just kind of plunges. She has an idea. She just plunges in. Let's try this and go with it, you know? And so in different ways, they were both, and Elle and I were performing in both those pieces. So for us, it was just a great experience to be asked to do things in ways that we weren't accustomed to and that we learned a lot.
I love all that. That is so fantastic. What a great show. So With this piece, as we are rolling into production in about a few, 3 weeks, I think it is. What has it been like developing it and getting it up on its feet?
Well, as Ellen said, we started this quite a long time ago, and that's been working on it in the midst of other projects along the way. So we and pretty much the group of people have been constant, and we had to make a change in one of the musicians, but pretty much all the actors are the same. Oh, except for one. No, actually, two of the original actors couldn't do it. So, but then we've been working with this group of people for quite a while. So we've had a long development time, but it's a large piece. I mean, there's seven actors, three musicians, a lot going on set-wise, costume-wise. So we have basically 4 weeks, to put together. So it seems like not much time, So one of the things we do, Ellen and I have a loft down in Soho where we often rehearse the shows, and we've built a mock-up of the set in our loft. Like, we've made these panels that are going to be in the show out of cardboard, but they can rotate and spin, so we can really work out the choreography before we move into the space. We don't move into the space until, a week before we open. So we're trying to, anticipate as much as possible what it's going to be like in that space, and try to, really get very precise with all this pretty complicated choreography, which not only doesn't just involve the panels, it moves a lot of costume changes.
Right, because these characters are transforming slowly throughout the piece. So the clothes have to accumulate in a way that starts in point A and ends up at point B.
And also to then coordinate it with the live musicians. I mean, in rehearsal, Ellen's recorded, she's worked on Sibelius, which is an electronic, composing software, what the instrumentalists are going to be playing. So we can use that in rehearsal when the instrumentalists aren't here, because, instrumentalists often have even crazier lives than actors in terms of teaching.
Piecing your life together so you can pay your rent, basically.
And playing with different ensembles and, going on tour. So we only have them for some of the rehearsals. So we're trying to, and a lot of it really has to be really well coordinated with them. So again, we're trying as much as possible to figure out all that coordination in advance, knowing that there's going to be a lot found out once they're in the room with us again.
That is fantastic. Ellen, I want to come to you for this next question. And I'm curious to know, with all these wonderful elements and these wonderful, stories being told, is there a message or a thought you hope that audiences take away from the piece?
Well, I think things, people can take what I hope that it's open enough that I love it that the audience comes with all of their ideas and imaginations so that you can, that the performing of the piece is almost like, an exchange of ideas with other people, and so what they might take away might be different. But I feel like I'm always writing the same play, which is something about people who are very different from each other, become a kind of family to each other. And, that's a very positive kind of thing that we find, especially in this play where people have been isolated for a while, and then they find new ways of interacting with other people that, that make things more than the sum of their parts. I think that's one of the things that, and then, how a person is, that you're not never stuck in who you are, that things are always changing, that you have a certain amount of power to change how you are, and that you kind of have to go with the flow and realize the things, that we're sort of always remaking ourselves throughout our lives in ways that can be satisfying.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No.
Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I was just, as Ellen was talking, it just occurred to me, the last piece we did, Existentialism, was a lot of it was based on writings of Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre and other existentialists. And of course, the kind of central thing of existentialism is that you choose who you are, in a way that you will yourself to be, to define yourself and what you are. And because there's no outside power or authority that's determining that for you.
And at the same time, you're kind of stuck with the historical, whatever, you know, with where you are and what is going on.
Right.
And you can't control that, but you can control how you
respond to it.
Yeah,
so that within the confines of whatever historical moment you're in, whether it's a pandemic or whether it's a war, because they wrote it during the Second World War, a lot of their thinking about existentialism, there's a lot of, you still have the power of choice, no matter how either confining or dire or scary what's happening in the world seems, you still always have this room for choice. And I think that's what's happening in this piece as well. I mean, we weren't thinking about existentialism when we made this piece. It's just, it's interesting to me now in a certain way how those themes still inform this piece.
That is so fantastic. I love those ideas. And that leads to my final question for this first part, which I want to ask both of you. And that, of course, is who do you hope have access to Shimmer and Herringbone?
Well, we always hope, you know, that our audience keeps widening. I mean, we have a following of people, you know, who regularly come to see our work, but we're always hoping that the audience gets larger and more diverse. And it's been interesting because this has been the third production of this year, being at the Perelman Arts Center. I think that brought in, you know, some of our regulars, but it brought a whole new group of people who ordinarily had not seen our work. And I think working with Anne, that brought in a whole bunch of her fans of Anne Bogart's. So we've actually been doing really well, which we're so grateful for. The both first two shows were sold out, their entire run. And so we've already expanded our audience, because, and also we've offered discount tickets that people came to either of those works to come again to see the subsequent works in our season. So there's kind of been sort of a snowballing of that. But that being said, if you haven't seen our work either, we are definitely welcoming you.
And also the first five performances, right, we've made them pay as you wish, so that, you know, money shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, the ticket prices are pretty cheap anyway, but the first five performances are pay as you wish. So, you know, you can come pretty cheap if you don't have money to spare.
For the second part of our interview, we'd love to give our listeners a chance to get to know our guests a little bit better. Pull the curtain back, if you will. And I want to start with our regular first question, which is, what or who inspires you? What playwrights, composers, or shows have inspired you in the past, or are just some of your favorites? And Ellen, can I start first with you on that?
Sure. I mean, I feel like we're part of a history of, you know, downtown theater, because, you know, we've been around for a long time, but, you know, I feel that I have connections with a lot of different people that are doing a lot of different work downtown. I mean, our original, where Paul and I met each other and what was my first introduction to theater in the 1960s was the Open Theater, which was directed by Joe Chaykin. And I started out as an intern there. Paul was already a performer in the group. And I, you know, for me, it was like, you know, I was in my early 20s. It was like such an eye-opening thing to find out that there was this theater where performers had an input into what the pieces were, that the pieces were about something important. You know, so for me, it was like, oh my God, this is great. And I, you know, I was lucky to be able to join the company after I finished my internship, which I started, you know, my last year of college. So for me, you know, that's a big, and so the way, you know, the kind of ways that Joe worked on things and how, you know, each project opened up new kinds of ways, they would try to figure out ways to explore whatever the subject was. And, you know, that was my initial inspiration for, you know, even though I'd been interested in theater before that, my parents were both involved in the arts. My father was a screenwriter, my mother was a dancer. But, you know, I wasn't sure that theater was for me because I worried that people were very self-involved and that there was, you know, there was some kind of commercial theater never really interested me. So even though I went to see musicals and stuff when I was a kid and just loved them, of course. But yeah, so for me, the open theater was like the sort of roots of my experience. And then I, you know, when I came to New York and was working with them, I just loved, you know, Meredith Monk and the work that Liz Suedos did as a composer with the theater. You know, we worked with her too, and she taught me a lot about composing music for theater. So I got very interested in that. When I was still in the open theater, this Dick Peasley was the composer that was working on the first piece I worked on with the open theater. And I just was very interested in the way that music was being, you know, integrated into the theater. And I became very interested in that.
Dick Peasley, by the way, was the composer who wrote the music for Peter Brook's Marat Sade, which was like a seminal kind of production.
So that was, yeah. So, yeah, I could say that. I mean, it's gone on because some of the, do you want to talk, Paul?
Go ahead.
No, just as, you know, as we, all the companies that we exist, you know, like Mabu Minds and the Worcester Group and Target Margin Theater and have all been, you know, very inspirational. And then also we started working with Taylor Mack, who's from the cabaret world. And he, the first piece that we did with him was called Lily's Revenge. And so Paul directed it had five acts. It was a 5-hour production at Here. That's where they did it. And, you know, I think part of Taylor's idea was to get his cabaret friends and his theater friends to meet each other, which is what we did. And so, you know, we became friends with and collaborators with a lot of cabaret performers and, you know, people who did strip teases and all kinds of stuff that was a little bit outside of our, you know, what we had been used to. And then we commissioned Taylor to write a piece for us, which was called Walk Across America for Mother Earth, which we did. And so it was a great collaboration with him and Machine Dazzle, who's also this costume designer that is really wonderful that he works with. So that was a big inspiration for us too.
Yeah, I think Ellen's putting it that the inspirations have to do within the context of this community of people that keep inspiring each other and working with each other in different forms. I mean, for example, from that Taylor Mack collaboration, one of the people in the show is James Tigger Ferguson, who, in addition to being a wonderful actor, is also a burlesque performer.
Mr. Exotic World.
And, you know, so we've worked with him a number of times. And so it keeps going, that those connections. Yeah. And like, I mean, you know, in terms of inspiration, I think, well, definitely for me also, Joe Chaykin was, you know, one of my main teachers about, because he was always questioning, you know, not only how to do theater, but why do theater, you know? That is, I just don't assume that there's a reason to do it. Why are you doing this piece? What is it that resonates for you and might resonate with other people? And also the idea that there's new ways of looking at what seems familiar, that there's a kind of, you can look at things from a kind of fresh angle. And, you know, Joe came out of really a kind of reaction to the 50s, where there was a certain kind of naturalism in theater that was the predominant mode, and it was kind of in movies and TV as well. And Joe had the strong feeling that wasn't his alone, that there was other ways of being and acting and behaving that was not being shown by that narrow, not that it wasn't true, the naturalism thing, but it was only one form of truth. So, you know, and part of that, there was, at the time, there was also all these other theaters from around the world that were very influential. Ariane Mnouchkine's company in France, Peter Brook's company in England, Jerzy Kratowski's company in Poland, also Tadeusz Kantor in Poland. These were companies that came here. A lot of them came to La Mama, some of them came to BAM. They were tremendously influential in seeing, oh, what's possible? That's, you know, people are doing things really differently. And even the people who were taking other directions, like Robert Wilson, was working the time, you know, which was a very kind of visual and more abstract theater, there were parts of that that really were inspiring. So I think what happens is not necessarily you take one person's work as a whole, but you go to see things and say, oh, that's really interesting, that thing they're doing there, that there's one aspect of the work that really excites you. And for example, last night we went to see Orlando, which is this new Sarah Ruhl piece that Taylor Mack stars in. And there were many wonderful things about that show. But one of the things was the costumes by Juana Botez, which were just amazing in a kind of imaginative way that was like so specific and wonderful. So, you look at that and say, wow, that's the way to go.
And a very talented and diverse cast in that show, also, that really were very singular and also worked really great as a team. That was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are wonderful lists. Wonderful lists. I love the artists that you named. So thank you for those. Well, we have now arrived at my favorite question to ask guests. And that, of course, is what is your favorite theater memory?
We've been doing theater for 50 years. I don't One memory is, I don't know, can
We could
speak.
talk about that, the old story about being in Shiraz and stuff. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
It's a
I mean,
good
I
story.
can tell.
I don't know if it's our best theater memory, but it's
I
funny.
could tell you a very striking theater memory, I mean, of which there are many, but, and you can jump in with the story
Yeah.
too. We were on tour with the Open Theater. This was a kind of a strange tour. We had been in Israel, then Algeria, and then Iran, and then we were on to Yugoslavia.
Yeah, it
And
was what year was this? 1971
1971,
or
yeah.
70, I can't remember.
And this was before the revolution in Iran, where there was still a Shah. And
The Shah's wife was really into theater,
yeah,
so they
and
had
she
this
was referred, she
festival.
was referred, it was a f it was a famous international festival in Shiraz, which is kind of where the,
It's like a
so,
desert. It's like at
yeah.
102 degrees
Well,
and
it was actually 140 degrees
oh,
when we were,
140 degrees, whatever. Very hot.
yeah. There was a lot of debate whether we should even go to Iran there because the Shah was a very repressive regime. But there was also a lot of debate whether we should go to Algeria. There was a lot of debate. And finally, we went thinking that, well, there were people there who actually wanted to see us and see some, maybe we could be a little kind of subversive influence there. So we went with a piece called Terminal that the Open Theater had made, and we had toured that all over. And Peter Brook's company was performing at the same time. They were performing a piece called Orgast that the poet, British poet Ted Hughes had written, and the composer Liz Suedos had written the music for. And Peter Brook, with his international company, was doing it there. And we were performing mostly the same nights that they were, so we couldn't see one of their regular performances. But they were doing a special command performance for the Queen, who's called the Shabanu. And so we weren't performing that night, so we were invited to that performance. And this is a really kind of military state at the time. And so on the way from Shiraz, the show is being done in Persepolis, which is this extraordinary ruins, ancient ruins
And
in,
they were doing it in the middle of the night
and
in the ruins.
they were doing it in the middle of the night in the ruins. And tell me if the story is too long, so we were taken in a bus out there, our company, to meet them. And all along the way, there were these soldiers that are lining the every like 100 yards, for miles, to get out there. And there was all these kind of clearance checks and stuff like that. And by the time we got to the ruins, the performance had already started. And we were told we couldn't go in. So that was the first half of the performance. The second half was going to be at another ruins, which was a little ways away. So we were going to wait to go to that. We were waiting, and then that ended that part. And Peter Brook's company came out, and we're all going to go to the second part. And for some kind of
Well, they
snap,
wouldn't let Peter Brook in because
right?
they didn't know who he was,
Well, yeah.
right? And so there
Well,
was like some
yeah,
kind
there
of
was some kind of
snafu like
snafu there.
that.
So
Everybody was very nervous,
everybody was very nervous. Yeah, all the soldiers were very nervous about
which was
everything.
bad because they had guns.
Yeah. So Peter Brook and our company, the Open Theater, were in these two buses, and we got out. The bus drivers wouldn't even drive us over to the second site. So we got out, and this was the middle of the night in the desert. And there was supposed we were all supposed to go to some restaurant after the whole show, which was a couple of miles away. So we decided we'd go walk to that restaurant now. And we were walking down this very flat road in the desert, this moon out. And as we go in, the Queen's entourage is coming the other way down this road towards the performance. And we meet in the middle of the desert. And there's this scene that takes place there. Irene Worth, who's a great British actor, was in Peter Brook's company at the time. And she pulled out full diva stops and to the Queen and to the Queen's brother-in-law, I think, who was the director of the festival. She went on, "I've never been so insulted in my whole life. We're not going to perform." And they came to this agreement where we would go to the restaurant now, and then they would perform after we ate at the restaurant. So we all now chuck off to the restaurant. Then we return to the site of the show. And the only audience in the show, and this is this incredible ruins with these stones, ancient stones and columns and stuff like that. And the only audience is us, the Queen, who's in this incredible gown,
Pierre Cardin, it was.
Pierre
It
Cardin suit,
was,
oh
yeah.
yeah, and her bodyguards, who are these huge guys. And it turns out the play is about regicide, about the killing of a king. So all of Peter Brook's actors are running around with these daggers and torches past the Queen, who's surrounded by this phalanx of bodyguards. And we're standing watching it like we're watching this play within a play or this movie within a movie that you could hardly believe, where there's this play going about killing the king, and this actual queen was surrounded by her bodyguards who was scared to death that she's going to be injured by these actors.
Anyway,
Anyway,
that's it.
she didn't get killed.
She didn't
It
get killed.
proceeded, it ended when the sun rising over the ruins, as was intended, and it was a kind of amazing theatrical event.
Holy cow. Wow, what a story. What a memory. Thank you both for that. That is incredible. Absolutely incredible. Well, now we've arrived at my final question, which is if our listeners would like more information about Shimmer and Herringbone or about either of you, maybe they'd like to reach out to you. How can they do so?
Yeah, so we have a website, talkingband.org. It's got information about Shimmer and Herringbone. It's got really kind of nice documentation of a lot of our past works, photos, some videos, and information about that. It also has a way to contact us through that website, and we'd be glad to hear from you and get back to you. So I think that's probably the best way, just talkingband.org. You can also, if you wanted to write an email directly, just talkingban@gmail.com.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, Ellen, thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me, to share this incredible show, that amazing memory. Oh my gosh, this has just been such a wonderful conversation. So I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
It's
you.
been really
Thank you.
nice talking with
Yeah,
you.
nice talking.
My guests today have been the co-writer and director Paul Zimmet and the co-writer, composer, and performer Ellen Maddow. They joined us today to talk about Talking Band's presentation of Shimmer and Herringbone, playing May 1st through the 19th at Mabu Minds at 122 CC. You can get your tickets and more information by visiting talkingband.org. We also have some contact information for our guests, which will be posted on our episode description as well as on our social media posts. But make sure you get your tickets for this gorgeous, gorgeous, fascinating show, Shimmer and Herringbone, playing May 1st through the 19th. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez, reminding you to turn off your cell phones. Unwrap your candies
And keep talking about the theater.
in a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.